no more to do with it. See, I don't want to come across as the insensitive type, no. But the truth be known, I'm lost all my patience, you have tried. Yeah. I lost all sense of time, you caused this mix-up in my mind. You tied me out, I'm feeling strung out, yeah.
Baby, I set the tone, made me step out of this on my own. Acting like nothing's wrong, needed time out to just be alone. Understand, you don't own this, man. Baby, I set the tone, yeah.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 63. No reviews, just analysis. I'm Aaron Myers, and my co-host, as always, is Andrea Shockling. Up this week, two comics from October 22nd, 2014. Colder number one and Goners number one. On the couch, we welcome artist Jim Rugg. And in between segments, listen to another second opinion. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so there may be spoilers ahead.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. It's still October, kids, and we're still reading scary books. Because when I hit on a theme, I like to really drive it into the ground, killing it slowly until its rotting, festering remains poison the water supply, causing pestilence and death for miles around, at least for the next 2 weeks anyway. Today's theme is about setting the tone. We're looking at two first issues of new horror series and how they establish the look and fear of what is to come.
All right.
What?
We all know the reason, though, when you set it on a theme, is just so you don't have to think of another theme.
I've never done this before with, like, a monthly theme, so I feel like that's not entirely fair.
Okay, well, we'll see what November brings.
It's not going to be more scary books.
No, it'll be, this month's theme is snow.
There's no snow in California.
There's that, okay. This month's theme is palm trees.
Turkey.
All month long. Giving thanks. Saying thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
You're welcome.
Each episode, in between comic segments, you'll hear one listener answering a series of questions, sharing his or her favorite comics, creators, and more. We call it a second opinion, and this week's is brought to you by Jason Sachs. Jason is the publisher and owner of Comics Bulletin, and the author of American Comic Book Chronicles, The 70s. He also has exquisite taste in vodka. If you want to leave your own response for us to use on a future show, the prompts are on the website, comicstherapy.com, and you can call, Skype, or email your MP3. Remember to read comics responsibly, kids, and always get a second opinion.
Hi, guys. I'm Jason Sachs at Jason Sachs on the Twitters. Thanks to Aaron and Andrea for asking me to be part of the second opinion deal. It's really fun to hear everyone's take on the world and their passion for comics and everything else. So it's fun to be part of this. So I've been reading comics as long as I can remember. In fact, some of my earliest memories involve, well, reading in general. I remember sitting at my parents' house in Queens, New York, and my dad used to get the New York Times every week, and I'd try, daily rather, he'd get the Times daily, and I would try to read the Times, and I probably didn't get much out of it. There were no comics or anything in it, but my parents were impressed in any way that I could, like, say Henry Kissinger back to them. But I remember distinctly going when I was a kid and picking up comics at the corner store when comics were 25 cents each. Yes, that means I'm dating myself, and my allowance was pegged to the price of comics. Literally at that point, everyone I know read comics. And in fact, we moved in the middle of fourth grade, and I wrote a letter to my old fourth grade classroom for my new home. And all I talked about in my letter to my friends was comics. I called myself The Hulk. Hey, I'm the Hulk sending you mail. I was very infatuated with old Greenskin and desperately wanted to be like Bruce Banner for reasons that a lot of us who grew up in imperfect households can probably relate to. The cool thing about comics, to me growing up, is two things. One is that my friends were always into comics. I was always trading and talking comics with my elementary and even my middle school friends. I had a really good friend named Chris who introduced me to fanzines in the early 1980s. He picked up a zine called Omniverse that Mark Grunewald edited. It's got covers and art by future professionals like Jerry Ordway. It's a really cool magazine about cross-continuity in comics. And from there, at the time that most people are kind of growing out of comics, I grew more into comics. Fell into fanzines and APAs and kept reading comics really all through high school because people like Frank Miller, John Byrne, and George Perez were doing just amazing work. I was really grooving on Miller, especially on Daredevil. And then when I got to college, comics were getting more and more mature when I was in college, too. I remember distinctly picking up issues of American Splendor, Eddie Campbell's Alec, Love and Rockets, and just like loving the fact that comics were so mature and adult. So I really never have stopped reading comics, except ironically for a short period after I worked on staff at Fantagraphics Books on Amazing Heroes magazine, but have really fallen back into comics, especially in the last, 10 years or so. I run Comics Bulletin. Please check us out, www.comicsbulletin.com. And I like to think I know a lot about comics these days. Who knows?
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Aaron Myers and Andrea at Andrea Schock. The show account that we mutually run is at Comics Therapy.
No one is going to believe you ever when you say that.
If you say a lie enough, it becomes truth.
Except for this one, because I discount it every single time you bring it up.
And then I edit that out. Continue.
Also, all you have to do is look at the rampant typos in the Comics Therapy account, and I would never put my name on that.
Well, you still send me all the tweets, so...
True. And when I do, there's a noticeable difference between the shit that you put out.
It's true. We get about twice the amount of listeners when I put up the tweets.
Aw, you're adorable. Why do you Thank always you. Ask me to do them, then?
I'm just super lazy.
That's true. How's your week?
It's been for good.
Are you sure?
It's been for fine good. Yeah. Comics, kids, coffee, and work.
Sounds like a typical week in Chateau de Myers.
Mm-hmm. This weekend is going to be very special.
Well, why?
I'm going up to Portland, Oregon.
Are you? I didn't know that.
Yeah, just on a Saturday.
Why didn't you tell me that you were doing that?
Because you don't live with me, and that doesn't matter.
You're, like, hesitantly wondering why I would give a fuck what you're doing on your Saturday. I like that.
Right.
What are you doing in Portland?
There is a comic swap meet.
Oh, are you going up for, like, this little, like, fun thing our friends are doing?
Well, our friends are attending along with me. They're not putting it on.
Oh, for real? I actually thought, just from eavesdropping with everyone talking about it, that it was just, like, our guys doing it. Yeah. It's, like, a legit thing that people are going to?
Yeah, it's a whole bunch of vendors.
Holy shit, I didn't know that.
It's more like, it's like a comic swap meet. So,
wow.
So I got a table with two people of our friends. I'll leave them anonymous at this point.
Oh, okay. Why?
I don't know. To protect them.
They're not innocent, so I'm not sure why you're protecting them.
And so we're splitting a table because I don't think any of us have that much stuff to bring.
Aaron, I've been to your house. I don't live with you, but I've been to your house more than once. You have plenty of fucking things to bring.
Yeah, I don't want to sell them, though.
Okay.
So I'm only bringing a little bit of things that I want to sell.
What is your version of a little bit of things?
Like two short boxes of comics and two bins of toys.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. And then, so it's like a... I don't know. I haven't ever been to it, but it looks like it's both comics, regular comics vendors, because like one of the local stores I go to, she's bringing her books up. She's going to get a table too.
Okay.
It's really cheap to get a table. So, you know, it doesn't really cost you much.
Okay.
And then it's everyone just kind of brings like a flea market in a way. So you could sell, trade, swap, whatever.
And it's kind of whatever the individuals want to do.
Yeah, and I think it's basically limited to toys and comics and collectibles. I don't know how much, like, VHS tapes
or... What about cards?
I don't... I didn't see cards on the list. Probably not, unless they're like comics or superhero related. Probably not sports cards.
Got it. Okay. But like Magic?
Maybe. Probably people would have stuff like that, I would imagine. I don't know.
I don't really have the same sense that you do, just because of your experience in collectibles, how much of an overlap there is in those two fandoms. So I was just curious. It doesn't matter. I was just wondering.
Yeah, I would say it's probably pretty decent.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they're not, they certainly, one doesn't negate the other.
No, not at all. But I feel like if I saw, is this open to the public or can you only participate if you have a table?
No, you can, it's open to the public. Okay. I don't even know what it costs to get a ticket. I don't think it's very much.
So if I saw that was a thing that was happening, I would be more interested in going and kind of wandering around. If the emphasis was, like you said, on comics and maybe toys, I think the addition of cards and in fact the use of the words Magic the Gathering would be a turnoff for me, just because I have zero interest in that. Not because I have anything against it, but just because like I am much more likely to buy an individual issue of a comic either for myself for sentimental reasons or as a gift for someone than I am to like want to go and look at somebody's cards.
Sure. I think it is definitely billed as a comic swap.
Cool. How big is it?
I don't know. I can report back to you next week.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are you going to get for me? Something exciting?
No, it is not a convention. I am not required to purchase you anything.
Required.
It's like going to a garage sale and saying, what did you get me?
Like your guy with the trailer. But you're kind of one of
storage
the guys
unit. I am not required to buy you something from Storage Unit Daryl every time I go there.
Is his name really Daryl?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're doing on Saturday.
It's my Saturday.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. It'll be fun. I'm really back into VHS now.
Of course you are.
My parents brought all my tapes and
your
my
parents
VHS
brought
tapes.
Your cassette tapes and your VHS tapes.
Uh huh.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really nice to revisit those mediums. Like, it's just, you can't reproduce the warmth of analog.
Who are you?
I'm me. I'm just me, man. Just enjoying life, revisiting my...
Your childhood.
Yeah. Okay. I listened to some very odd music.
Your collection was inspiring.
Thank you. It was mostly, I grew up very far away from town. And I would buy packs of blank tapes and give them to kids at school and just tell them, like, copy me whatever you like. Because, like, I basically grew up pretty disconnected from popular culture.
No.
Yes.
Shocking.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even radio. Like, we didn't pick up radio signals that great, so there weren't that many stations. God.
And people call me sheltered.
Yeah. So I was starving for any kind of like music and pop culture by the time I got to high school.
So I came back from New York. Did I mention that I was in New York recently?
Yes.
I'm not sure if that came up.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So I've been listening to punk of all different varieties and flavors nonstop since I got home from New York.
Because
two reasons. Conrad had a Dead Kennedys sweatshirt on. And so I was like, oh God, I love them when I was 15. Let's do that again. And the thing is, I still kind of love it. Like, really a lot.
Mm.
And then Roderick had another band that I was not familiar with that he sent me the album of, the newer album. And I really enjoy it. I've been listening to it a lot. And
yeah, so. I've tried to revisit my punk roots, and some of it is fine, stands up, but... I feel old listening to it now.
I'm fine with that. I've been listening to Bad Religion, like, nonstop for the past 2 days. Mm. That doesn't make me feel old, because they're old, too.
Right, that should make you feel... it should make you feel old. They're, like, in their 50s now.
Right. So, I think that there's something about the nostalgia, but, like, you're not going to revisit these cassette tapes of your idiosyncratic childhood... Seriously, unless there's actually something of substance there. right? Like, I'm not completely making fun of you, just half making fun of you for that. Because you had some good stuff. You had, like, fucking Beastie Boys on there. That's great. Mm-hmm. There's nothing laughable about continuing to listen to the Beastie Boys, right?
I guess.
Come on.
I find it harder and harder to re-listen to things without, unless I'm listening to them for memory, you know, evocation.
I don't understand that. I feel like if it has really great content,
let me explain it to you.
But no, I'm going to ask my question first and then you can mansplain. How is listening to music that has really universal content any different from revisiting prose or comics in the same way?
I could explain that to you, but I'm going to explain to you my music collection and why it's hard for me to revisit it. Because I grew up so far away from town, mm-hmm. going to high school, my trip on the bus was an hour and a half each way. Mm-hmm. So I've listened to every one of those tapes hundreds of times in the course of my high school career. So there's not much to revisit there that doesn't get kind of burnt out pretty quick.
How many years ago were you in high school, Aaron?
Feels like 4 or 5 now.
Okay, but in reality, how many years ago were you in high school?
Yeah, a while.
Like 20.
Okay.
And you're telling me that the stuff you listened to 20 years ago during your epically long bus rides is still too fresh in your mind that you can't listen to it now without getting burned out?
We talk every week, and you know my mind is like a steel trap, sharp as a razor's edge. And it thirsts, it yearns for new information.
Whereas mine is like a fucking sieve.
Yeah,
and
Swiss
I'm
cheese.
Still hearing about conversations that I had in New York that I have no memory of.
Right, you're like, oh cool, the Dead Kennedys, I hear they're pretty cool.
Right.
And then somebody hands you the tape again, you go, oh, the Dead Kennedys, I hear they're pretty cool.
Goldfish, yep.
Yeah, I envy that.
Yep.
The whole world, every moment, every nuance, every detail,
it just gets
filtered in and locked away.
For you? Or
yeah.
For me?
No, for me.
Huh. Okay.
Well, you just kind of float through life. It could be Groundhog's Day would be the greatest thing for you because every day would be brand new and fresh.
You're right.
Yeah, it's you live such a blessed life.
I do. I live such a blessed life.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk about
comics? And you get to talk to me every week, and it's like brand new.
It is. God, because otherwise, I don't know why I would still be doing this.
Let's talk about some comics. Maybe we've even talked about these comics before. You don't know.
No, I do know that we haven't because, contrary to your very strong opinion, these are both number ones.
Oh.
So, it is categorically impossible for us to have discussed either one of these comics before.
So, we're recycling themes and we're talking about number ones.
There
we're
is no all the recycling. Rules. The larger kind of world of the theme is scary books. But the specific theme is setting the tone. How these scary books are, like, pulling us in for the first issue.
Let's do it.
I like to read floppies. As I look around my home office, I see stacks and stacks of floppy comics. Everything from old copies of Don McGregor's Nathaniel Dusk, drawn by Gene Colan, to this week's issue of Low, to Lars Brown's penultimate quest that he kickstarted, bunch of old zines like Cartosia, or not old zines, but minis like Cartosia Tales. I just love comics. So my favorite shop that I like to go to is Arcane Comics in Ballard, Seattle, Washington. It's a great shop, very friendly. The owners are very cool, and they know your name. They often have beers on New Comic Wednesday, which is awesome and fun. I have a number of friends who go there every week, and it's nice to just go and hang out. But, of course, I also like to get comics online, and I have subscriptions to a number of the small press publishers especially. Really, for me, that's the stuff that I love the most. I do love the Artifact of Comics, though.
Our first book this week is Colder Number 1, written by Paul Tobin and drawn by Juan Ferreira, with color assistance by Eduardo Ferreira and lettering by Nate Piquios. Colder is published by Dark Horse Comics.
I didn't do summaries for either of these because they're number ones.
Okay.
Well, the whole point is that we're talking about how well it sets up the story. So I felt like it was a little bit inauthentic to be like, here's the story so far.
Okay. But Colder is a number one of the second volume slash arc of the story.
It is. And while I have the other ones, I will say right now that I haven't read them. And I did that deliberately. I know we talked about it last night. Oh, Andrea, you should read these. Actually, I said, Andrea, I should read these. But I thought about it, and honestly, maybe I needed to embrace the theme a little bit more and be able to explain from my perspective how it was jumping in on this. Kind of like what we did with American Vampire, because I know that you read the other issues of Colder. And so this is about, like, how it is to be pulled into this, like, horror atmosphere with this very first issue. And, like, if it does its job.
That is such a elegant explanation for just not doing your homework.
Yeah, dude, you know what? I couldn't come up with a better excuse for not having gotten caught up on The Walking Dead, so I had to come up with something for this.
Yeah, that, no one else is buying that either, but I give you an A for effort.
Wait, so, no one else is buying what? Why I didn't? That,
yeah, why you didn't read it.
What, The Walking Dead?
No, Colder.
Oh, I just didn't have time.
Right, sure.
That one is, the previous volume is, what, 5 or 6? It's like a single arc, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, correct. So I actually have every intention of reading it, because part of what I want to say about this first issue is that the implied backstory is enough for me to have questions in a good way. And so knowing that I can go back and, like, fill them in is a bonus, not required, but is, like, accessible. As opposed to, for me to get caught up on The Walking Dead at this point is about 30 issues, and, like, fuck that noise right now.
Okay, fine. So tell me about this. Tell me about your impressions.
Super creepy. Like, way, way more viscerally, grotesque than any of the other quote-unquote horror books that we've talked about in this cop-out month-long theme that we're doing. And so much of that is related to, like, the visual presentation of that grossness that is, I think, like, a really necessary part of, here's the beginning of this story, are you in? Like, if you don't have the If you don't have the complete package of, like, this is as horrific, or maybe even a taste of how horrific it could be from the get-go, then it's not going to be as successful. And in this case, like I said, I've got some questions, but they're all because I'm intrigued. And I'm intrigued about how kind of fucked up it was. And that's a really delicate balance that they're kind of able to attain here. It's yucky, but it's yucky in a super cool way.
Yeah, it's hard with it's not, it's monster horror, and it's kind of like slashery kind of horror in this first issue.
But smarter than that.
Right, that's too reductive.
Yeah.
But there is, like, for setting that tone, violence is a very good way of kind of getting your hackles up and your defenses up. And kind of setting off that fear response.
Especially if it's unprovoked violence.
Right. Kind of chaotic violence.
Right. And so in this case, that's the kind of violence that we have, that it's, I haven't figured out if there's any kind of link with the victims. It's just, like you said, it's like chaotic, and it's super random and very extreme. And you're right that, like, that sets off a whole bunch of bells about, okay, here's what you can expect. Like, if this is the bare minimum, it's going to be a whole lot worse, but in a good way, you know, soon.
What is it about horror books like this, or horror movies or TV shows, that I always find it kind of fascinating that they can elicit that response, the emotional response, even without the actual threats of violence or, you know, danger.
How so? How is there not a threat of violence or danger?
To the reader, to the person experiencing the story. You know, the whole, like, I guess that goes to the whole thing of entertainment, that our brains are like non-conscious kind of, like, reptilian part of our brains really kind of drive entertainment, don't they?
Well, when it is random, there is always, I find, like a heightened ability to project, like, myself into the story, just because as of this first issue, there's no pattern to it. And so it's like, literally, you could be walking down the street and this crazy, horrific thing occurs. So I think that's one thing that a lot of people find sort of appealing, is the, like, the universal nature of horror. But then I also think that generally there are two horror camps, right? There's like the more paranormal stuff, and then there's the more slasher stuff. There's things beyond our explanation that are causing the horror, and then there's like the horror that we cause to ourselves.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, for the most part, I have always been drawn to the paranormal stuff. Drawn to it, repulsed by it, like, obsessed with it, and then, like, fearful of it. And I have a very complicated relationship with that push and pull, but it's way more interesting to me than, like, gratuitous kind of slasher horror that's just yucky, like, without the cool factor. And I wish I had a better way of articulating it than words like yucky and cool, but it's just totally uninteresting to me. Whereas the paranormal stuff, and in this case what that translates to is like the kind of visual monsters that are related to the mental illnesses and to like the way that the main monster is viewed, like, by the reader versus by the other, like, by the public. I think that's, like, I enjoy that balance quite a bit.
I think for me, I find them both terrifying in different ways. I've always found kind of the quote-unquote, like, real-life kind of horror to be more uncomfortable, because I hate having that visualization of kind of helplessness,
mm-hmm.
of being at the mercy of, like, someone real, you know, not like a Freddy Krueger or, you know, some sort of monster or something like that, because then there's the fantastical aspects to it.
Mm-hmm.
But like a movie where somebody is, you know, trapped and being tortured or, you know, that sort of stuff always is harder. I don't like that at all.
But when you say you don't like it, does that mean that you actually do like it? Like, that's the kind of scared you like to be?
No. I don't really like horror movies that much.
Okay.
I don't mind horror books. I'd say I like horror books. I think there's been phases of my life where I liked them more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I used to read tons of Stephen King. I haven't in a while, but as a kid I did. And I don't know if I even liked the scary aspects of his books. I think I liked his writing more.
Stephen King is a great example of somebody who toes the line between those two types that I sort of boldly declared are the only two types of horror, even though I don't know shit about the genre. But he certainly is really good about describing the terrible things that we do to ourselves, but then mm-hmm. obviously is like a master of more of the like occult paranormal stuff as well.
Right. Like, did you ever read Needful Things?
Yes.
Which yeah. is a great story, and it's a supernatural aspect to it, but really it's about kind of human desire and right. greed and like all the bad things inside of us.
Right. And even some of his other like bigger epic tales of like good versus evil, like the stand. Right. Yeah. There's a bunch of just like terrible people doing terrible things in that as well.
Yeah, I mean it is a common theme for that kind of stuff. There's right. a comic you should check out called The Walking Dead.
Oh,
that touches on some of those.
Tell
things.
Me about that. I don't think I've heard of it.
I think you'd love it.
Is it new?
Yeah, pretty new.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's it about?
You know, it's like a mortuary kind of thing, and it's like, you know, puppetry, and I don't want to spoil it for you.
Mortuary and puppetry. You were just pulling those words out of your ass just to make sure that thinking, you weren't like, saying zombies. You know,
The Walking Dead.
Oh, I see what you did there. Clever.
That was the original pitch.
Yeah. Like Phantasmagoria style?
Sure. Well, you want to talk about our next book?
I guess. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I want to circle back and acknowledge about this. I think just that, like, the balance with Stephen King, I feel like there is a likelihood of that line, of those two types of horror being really prominent in Colder as well. It seems likely that is sort of something that Declan has experienced, like the terrible things that we do to each other, but then he has this kind of knowledge of the monsters that might be behind it. And I think as I have become a little bit more aware of what works for me as a horror fan, and I use that term extremely lightly and loosely, that is a balance that I'm looking forward to seeing more of.
Wonderful.
Let's do it. Next one.
My favorite book right now is probably Black Science. Rick Remender and Matteo Scalera are just killing it with this series. It's got this emotional side to it. The characters are so distinct, interesting, and complex, and really flawed in the way that Remender is so good at. I mean, these are just messed up people who have messed up lives, and yet they persevere and they battle and they do everything they can to get through these incredible landscapes with these bizarre creatures that Scalera creates. It's a world that seems both fully fleshed out and fully improvised all at the same time. And that just makes it really exciting.
Our second book this week is Goners Number One, written by Jacob Saman. And drawn by Jorge Corona. Colors are by Gabriel Castada. And lettering is by Steve Wands. Goners is published by Image Comics.
Okay. I have some pretty high praise for this book. So you go first.
But you're not going to review it.
I'm not going to review it. I'm going to liken it to something else that I'm having trouble not just making this all about my opinion this week. Surprise. But you go first with your non-review and help me curtail mine and pull it back more towards analysis, please.
Well, not in a review. The things that I liked about this.
No, dude, you can't fucking throw me under the bus like that and then start a sentence with, these are the things that I like.
No, well, this is the thing that I like in terms of setup and an introduction.
Right on.
And framing the story.
Okay.
So the idea of, like, legacy.
You really like that.
I do like the idea of legacy.
Yeah.
It's a good framing device for stories. Like being revealed a destiny because of legacy, or characters who have an established kind of job because of who their lineage is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's solid. It's a solid place to start from.
Okay. And it's
especially you can have a character who rebels against that too.
Okay. So that's something that you relate to and that is a hook for you regardless of the genre.
Well, I mean, I can't talk about what my family is responsible for. Let's just say we've saved the world many times.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I mean, it's something I relate to.
Got it.
Okay.
What else?
But that kind of introduction or step up to your destiny,
mm-hmm.
in terms of this and monsters and horror and that kind of thing is very shocking.
Yes.
Especially when you're dealing with children and parents.
Right. It's a trial by fire isn't quite exactly the right terminology, but it is a kind of immediately thrust upon you kind of sense of destiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And and not even enough time to process the trauma of what maybe brought you to that point.
Exactly, exactly. And so, I think that just like with Colder, when you have that violent act to kind of set the tone, there is something that is like intrinsically successful about starting a story with something that is so dramatically awful for the characters to experience.
Mm-hmm.
We relate to their plight and we like empathize perhaps because of this awful thing that they have gone through, and the fact that it is paranormal in nature or it is like hyper violent in nature just makes it like all the more, I guess, like all the more real in how unrealistic it is. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and for me too, it's also, all you need to do is throw kids and parents into desperate and dangerous situations, and there's going to be an emotional connection for me. Hmm. Again, I can't go into the details of why, but...
Right. It has nothing to do with you being a parent.
No. Just a protector of the nth dimension that we reside in. Got I've it. Said too much.
You have. Do you have to kill me now?
Not now, but it's in the works.
So I got a bit of a Lock and Key vibe from this first issue.
Hmm. That is high praise.
It is very high praise. And that's why I'm tempering it with a bit of. Because I think it's pretty well documented that Lock and Key is my favorite series ever. So I don't want to be like overly lauding this. It is the first issue, but we are talking about why some first issues, in this case these two, might be more successful or less successful in setting the tone. And in mm-hmm. this case, there are a couple of elements that I think work well, some of which you talked about, but the balance of light and dark, I think, works really well in horror. For somebody like me who doesn't want to be like completely devoid of hope.
Mm.
So yeah. I need there to be an occasional human moment that is self-reflective or that is comedic or that is just like a little bit lighter than everything is dire and everybody is dying. And that's, if you recall, one of the things that I really struggled with The Walking Dead. Is that it was just fucking dire always. And there were a couple mm-hmm. of lighter moments in this. And that like self-awareness of the craziness, I think, has like some good potential to continue that balance between light and dark. But at the same time, it was never silly. And in order for me to take a horror story seriously, there have to be high enough stakes. They have to feel like there is danger. And, like, people died right off the bat. We're killing off the parents. There was no, like, sweeping or, like, gesture of safety kind of at the last minute.
Yeah.
So I think that that's what really struck me as successful, is that this was fucking real. And it was real in both the light and the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the visceral fear and connection and that framing that hooks you in. Because even though you knew things are bad, you want to make sure who's left gets out okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So now we have an investment in not only this kind of tragedy that has befallen the family, but like we also have some intrigue into kind of the larger world and why that tragedy existed. Like there's a lot of things at play here for like hooking us into a story like this, which is more, I think horror is a hard genre to like set the tone with because there are so many redundant horror storylines.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's only so many times you can tell the story of a haunting. So why do I care? I care about the people who are being haunted. There's only so many times you can tell the story of a ghost hunter. Why do I care? I care about the personality of said ghost hunter. Or in this case, I care about what happens when the ghost hunters are killed and the children remain.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a non-horror storyline, like with conspiracy potentially.
Yeah.
And right. That makes it, I think, slightly more sophisticated and like less reliant on the horror tropes that can get really tiresome. So that's another thing that you want to throw in there from the very beginning of like, hey, this is probably not going to be 100% predictable. Just follow along and there's going to be like some layers to this as we unpack this story that could have been just another scary tale, but we're trying to do more with it.
Well, besides having a supernatural kind of threats and violence and that sort of stuff, that kind of visceral horror, you have those threats of the unknown, you have what you don't know from the people you think you trust, you know, as a different kind of horror.
Oh, good. We're back to that line again between man's inhumanity to man and like ghosts' inhumanity to man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ghosts usually treat people better than people treat each other.
True.
Well, speaking of man ghosts.
Really? Man, yeah. Are we back to your worst transitions ever?
Let's talk to famed man ghost, Jim Rugg.
You're starting a rumor here that I'm not particularly comfortable with.
We'll see if it catches on.
I don't think it's going to.
I can always hope.
Another favorite book right now is Sex Criminals. For anyone who reads Sex Criminals, you know why I love it. Because it's got this energy and this passion and this reminder of what it's like to be young, falling in love, dealing with all the complexity of the world that you're living in. And, you know, I just dig the euphoria of the series. I just think it's just a wonderful book because Fraction is just killing it, along with Chip Zdarsky.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Ignatz Award-winning artist Jim Rugg. Back in episode 53, we talked about Jim's comic Street Angel, published by SLG originally, re-released digitally by Monkey Brain Comics, and beautifully packaged in a newish hardcover by Ad House. He's also the co-creator of Rambo 3.5 and Aphrodisiac. He drew The Guild, written by Felicia Day and published by Dark Horse Comics, and pages for Joe Casey's new Captain Victory series, which we've also talked about, published by Dynamite. He also lives in Pittsburgh, so prepare yourself in advance for some reminiscing about my hometown, Myers. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, so you have a few projects in the works with Joe Casey, including Captain Victory, and I believe something else for Dark Horse Presents.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I actually just finished the Dark Horse Presents story. I'm not sure when that will be published, but it's probably on the schedule at this point.
Uh-huh.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think it seems to be like once they get turned in, it's about a 6-month. I think it is like what seems to be what they have in the can, so to speak. Well, can you tell us what else you're working on for the rest of the year and into 2015?
No, I can't. I just signed.
Man, one of these days, somebody's going to tell us.
I just signed a non-disclosure agreement this past week for a really big project that's it's doing conceptual art for a film. Unfortunately, that's all I can say about it.
That's okay. That's totally cool.
You don't have
that.
To say anything. You just scan that and email that to me after the interview and put it on site.
I'm also working on my own a new comic book series, which has we have not signed contracts for yet. So in a lot of ways, I can't talk about anything right now.
Right.
But I am working on projects I'm very excited about. There's a lot of drawing in my for the rest of the year.
That's excellent.
Well, that's good.
And I discovered when I was just putting stuff together for our conversation today that Street Angel is also updated on Boing Boing every week. Is that correct?
Yeah, that just started. We've done 3 weeks so far. And,
okay.
You know, the plan is to continue updating that weekly indefinitely. So I'm very excited by that. You know, it's a different readership.
It is. When you say indefinitely, though, that implies there's going to be new ones. So I'm going to hold you to that.
Sounds good.
I want to talk first about design and color, because you're a graphic designer and you got a lot of attention for the flat pink color choice on the original Street Angel covers. And then those interiors and even some of your recent covers, like the Transformers G.I. Joe variant that you did for IDW, they have a very clean line and shadow balance that reminds me of a silkscreen. Can you talk a little bit about the intersection between graphic design and more traditional illustration and how they might inform one another with your work?
Yeah, I studied graphic design in college in the 90s. And at the time, I didn't realize how much that decision would influence my career. But in hindsight, you know, it's like the only other art form besides comics that really combines text and images together. Mm-hmm. And so it's very informative of the way I work and the way I think and even what I look at. You know, I look at a lot of graphic design work outside of comics. And as far as screen printing goes, the Center for Cartoon Studies in Vermont, they actually teach screen printing as part of their curriculum because they think it makes sense for learning color. You know, you're working with fewer colors whenever you're screen printing than right. you would be if you're working digitally. So it's a way to think about color a little more deliberately.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, you know, I enjoy screen printing. I don't do a lot of it, but I enjoy looking at it. There's a really good screen printing resource in Pittsburgh called Artist Image Resource.
Oh, are they still over on the north side?
Yes. And, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from really from any color application when it comes to comics, because comics were so limited in the way they produced color for most of their history. And now in the last 20 years, of course, you can produce comics using any color ideas you have pretty much, which is awesome, but there's still a lot of a learning curve. And so, you know, my work is informed by pretty much color that I see anywhere. Like this morning I was driving around looking at leaves, you know, fall foliage. Mm. So I love color. I'm more interested in color now than I've ever been. And it's a good time to work with color because so much of comics is presented now on screens, and screens are able to present color in a lot of ways. You know, they're able to present more color than we can do in print.
Hmm. So when you go back to how you're actually producing the color, you know, as an artist, knowing that a lot of that is going to be seen on a screen in addition to print, like it's not an either or kind of thing. Does that influence the choices that you then make to produce the color itself?
Yeah, sometimes I will produce two versions of a file. You know, if I'm doing a cover for someone, I will produce a version for digital distribution and I'll produce a version for print because the colors are very different from on screen to print. You know, and I think I'd written a blog post about Mike Mignola's Hellboy in Hell. I don't know, whenever that first came out, maybe a year and a half ago, because I saw it on screen and I was so impressed by how the color looked. And then when I got the print edition, and I read a lot of print, I like print, I was surprised by how much duller the colors looked.
Yeah, it's super muddy in the print version. Yeah.
So I, you know, I've started thinking about that more in my own work just because, you know, you see examples of it and then you try to apply it to whatever you're doing. And there is there's a massive difference between an iPad screen and a piece of printed paper.
Do you do most of your coloring digitally then?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, at some point, you know, all these files have to be digitized if you're going to be sending them either to a press or to something like Monkey Brains.
Right. Right.
Do you still have a preference now these days, like what you like to read?
Not really. I enjoy reading in bed. And for me, it's just easier for me to read with a book. Like I don't have an iPad. My wife has an iPad. So typically she's using that. So I still like print a lot, and I'm not sure I can explain why, besides like a nostalgic, you know, I think of books very fondly from just my entire life. And so that's probably part of it. I think a book as a delivery mechanism is a pretty good package. So
do you think though that you, like as a designer, you're also more influenced by like book as artifact, you know, because if you're sort of responsible for the packaging, like the production aspect of a book, then you have that tangible connection to it that way. I'm just wondering if you're influenced by like your role in that And so it's, so in addition to nostalgia, it's also like the importance of the final product itself has a lot of like resonance for you.
Yeah, definitely. I love making books. You know, I make a variety of books. I'm actually doing a talk on a very small edition of a book that I made earlier this year, tonight. But I do think of them as objects, you know, as like a complete thing, almost like a, I hate to say it, almost like a small sculpture or something. But, you know, I've had those experiences with books where like the paper feels amazing or, you know, the type of paper it's printed on does something where the colors just seem to be perfectly suited for the way they're being presented or the size works really well. And I'm definitely aware of those things. You know, I love books. I have way more books than I have room to really display.
Don't we all?
But I do have a fondness for that format. And I love seeing what people do with it, you know, from the paper that they choose. Like whenever we did the new Street Angel edition with Ad House Books, we contacted the art director at Pantheon because we liked one of the paper stocks they had used in a book. You know, so it does make a difference. And I do think those details add up to part of the experience. And I think a lot of people take that for granted. You know, it's not, I can't imagine that most people would buy a book just based on they love the paper that this book is printed on. I'm not even sure most people could articulate, you know, their response to a well-designed book, even though they may really like the book. It's not necessarily something that's, you know, people think about whenever they're reading a book.
Unless it's something like WYSIWYG or Building Stories that's like sort of pushing outside of the standard format, I guess.
Yeah, or if something is done poorly, you know, often you become aware of it, right?
Sure.
If something's printed very dark or if something's printed very small,
right.
You know, you can notice those types of mistakes. But when something's done well, a lot of times it just means you're able to get lost in the story more easily or more completely. And, you know, you may not think about the actual design of the book if the design of the book is doing its job well.
Right.
Well, let's talk about books. You got your start in the industry by self-publishing mini comics and kind of honing your style based on the story you and your collaborators were telling. I think you've often talked about the freedom that kind of work gives creators as they explore the medium. It's rarely commercially sustainable kind of in the long term. And we've talked to many creators who, like you, balance with more work-for-hire opportunities. Do you think that's just the way the industry is for now? Or do this, like, kind of do the stuff you have to pay for the bills so you can create the stuff you love?
Man, that's a big question.
We could take it in chunks.
I think it, you know, you're asking a lot there. I think that people come into comics for different reasons. I think there are plenty of people that just want to draw you know, an exciting Spider-Man story, and there's a place for that. I think there are people who want to make an entire publication. I don't know if you're familiar with Lamano Press in Minneapolis. Mm-mm. It's a very small imprint that's run basically by one artist, Zach Sally, and he makes very beautiful books and print objects, and his latest book is coming out. You know, he's publishing it through Lamano, but it's something like 9 colors and parts of it are printed on a risograph machine and some of it's offset printed and he's assembling it. And it's just this beautiful object. It's sort of about that object because it's something that he values in his work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think there's this range of artists and what you value in the work that you do and what your career aspirations are. I think that it's possible to make almost anything and have it be profitable if you enter it with that mindset. If your value is making profit off of the work, I think there's a way to do that with almost anything. I don't think everybody wants to work that way. You know, whenever we were recording our podcast and we were talking to artists about how they kind of handle the business end, it seems like there's a division between people who want to make a living off of their art and people who want to separate making a living and making art because, you know, possibly making a living off of your art compromises the creative choices that you make in some people's minds.
Sure.
Which is another debate altogether. But this is a long way of saying, I do think you can make very personal work. I think you can have a lot of control over that work. And I think you can make a living doing that. It's not easy to do, but I think it's doable. And, you know, there are people out there you can look to as examples of people that do that. You know, I'm essentially just making a comic. I've saved some money. I have created a cushion of time, if you will, where I'm able to just create some work. I believe that I'm going to sell that work. But if I don't sell that, you know, if it doesn't sell, it's not necessarily going to leave me homeless. But if it does sell, then I'm in a position where I'm just making the work that I want to make and making a living off of that. So, you know, I think everybody approaches this stuff differently. I think people are in different positions throughout their life when they're able to take these chances or they're able to, you know, make less money off of a project because they made more money off of a previous project, for example. So I don't know. There's no easy answer to that question.
Yeah, no, it's not supposed to be, though. But it's, I think it's a, I think it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of comics creation and what it means, what comics mean, you know, in general as a quote unquote comics, because it's hard to, I think it's hard for the average person to kind of wrap our head around the scope and the art form of comics in terms of the range being, you know, Superman to the independently published, you know, mad scribblings of someone who puts out five copies of something, you know, and took him 10 years, but it's all comics in the end.
Yeah. And I think it's more broad than that. Even, I worked on a book, a Little Nemo book, that Locust Moon is publishing.
Yes, and it's stunning.
Have you seen a copy of that?
Yeah, I have. I saw a copy a couple of weeks ago at Mission Comics in San Francisco. I saw one of the like advance like proof copies.
Right. And I mean, that's a project that was essentially self-published.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you know, we live in a time now where distribution options are almost infinite. Fundraising options are almost infinite. So really, whatever it is you want to make, you can probably figure out a way to make it. It's a little bit overwhelming at times. You know, you, I think most artists walk around with lists of ideas of things they want to do. And, you know, you can probably only get around to a couple of those things, maybe, depending on time and other factors. But I don't think it's ever been as, you know, the range of what you're, what is available is more broad now than it's ever been, you know, from Kickstarter to micro publishers, all the way up to major publishers like Dark Horse and Image and Pantheon and First Second. Like, there's just an enormous range of opportunities and options if you're creating a graphic novel or a comic book, whether it's a mini comic, an art comic, you know, whatever it is. It's just, it's hard to even describe it. You know, in terms of what is available now.
But I think that it sometimes comes back to that reality check of you can make the work, you can distribute the work, and people will pay to buy the work. And I completely agree with you that there are just infinite options, and it's actually really exciting. But the leap of faith that it takes to commit to doing just comics, I think especially for younger creators, can be really intimidating. Like the idea of comics as a sustainable industry, like as a career choice outside of working in mainstream comics, is still, there's a lot of unknowns there. And I, like we've heard from a creator points of view where you're doing things like what you just described, like you've saved some money from other projects so that now you can devote time and attention to something that you believe in, that you think is going to be commercially successful, but even if it isn't, like you're going to be fine. You're not going to be homeless. That's good. Good job. But for some younger creators, I think that they are, we hear a lot about that balance, that maybe it's working for somebody else and then working for yourself and then working for somebody else and then working for yourself, just so that you actually can pay the bills at the end of the day, so that comics can be it, or you balance it with a day job. We hear a lot about that from different folks that we've talked to as well. Do this.
I don't think comics are the only industry or the only art form that do that. You know, I think for a long time, filmmakers would talk about doing that, you know, making one for the studio and then making one for themselves.
Or
I think
actors,
that was a common
too,
practice.
Right?
Sure. Almost anyone, I think. And especially if you're working in a medium that's somewhat commercial, because then there is that potential to, you know, to make money off of these projects in a way that could then sustain a less commercially viable project. I think you're absolutely right about, you know, young creators maybe trying to figure this out. You know, when I graduated college, I worked a day job for 7 years, and part of that was saving, you know, was saving money and sort of creating a cushion Whenever I quit my day job, it was because I thought I had enough work lined up to, you know, sustain myself as a freelancer and especially one making comics. And it's when the economy took a downturn, I think in like 07 or 08, and I had two large projects that were like a year long each, and they both ended prematurely within 3 weeks of one another. And I was suddenly like without work, you know, because I had worked for 7 years in a job I didn't particularly care for, I had saved enough money that that wasn't a disaster. But, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty as a freelancer or as somebody that's just working for themselves. And so, you know, it's different for everyone, too. I would never tell somebody that they should quit their job and try doing this, you know, full time. Like, that's a very individual decision, I think. I think it is possible. I think it depends on what your goals are.
That's a good segue because I want to talk. Are you still teaching? I know that you were at the School of Visual Arts before.
Yes, this is my second year teaching there.
So I always want to talk about education because I'm a teacher too. So if we have a guest on the show who's both teaching and creating, I'm like all over that. So I'm curious, what, if any, trends you're seeing with up and coming artists, like with the next generation of sequential storytellers?
Well, the program that I teach in is called Visual Narrative. And so it encompasses more than just comics. You know, we have filmmakers and animators and people making video games. So from my point of view, and it's relatively small, I see a trend towards looking at visual narrative on a wider spectrum than just comics.
Okay.
You know, thinking about film editing is how does that influence comics or how could that be, you know, adopted by a cartoonist and vice versa, you know, filmmakers looking at comic books and seeing how storytelling unfolds there and
that's really
trying to bring that into their own form. And I think that, you know, I imagine that's happening on a wider scale than just this one program because we see content now online. So you watch a short film next to a web comic, you know, next to a Twitter feed of just all sorts of random stuff.
Right.
You know, so I imagine that all these different art forms are influencing one another more now than they ever have before. You know, I think I see a lot of young artists, whenever you ask them who their influences are, they just name a variety of artists working in different disciplines. I also see a lot of artists when you ask them what they do, they may have three or four disciplines that they're working in, which is a lot different than it used to be 20 years ago when people tend to specialize more. So I'd say that's probably the biggest trend that I would guess is pretty prevalent.
That's so interesting because there's a lot of conversation about vocabulary. And some of that tends to be centered around the art of criticism. So if you're going to have a conversation about film, there's a certain vocabulary. If you're going to have a conversation about comics, there's a lot of adoption of and adaptation of vocabulary from other disciplines to describe what's happening on the page, because there's some overlap, but it's obviously not the same. And so when you are describing these younger artists who are borrowing liberally from, and it sounds like dancing between the various mediums, I wonder if the vocabulary and our like insistence on the way that we describe the art making process is also going to need to be more fluid. If you're seeing storytelling techniques appear in slightly different ways in film, in comics, in, you know, other multimedia disciplines, that's actually super exciting to hear that overlap could be, you know, more welcoming for younger artists. Good stuff.
Yeah, the vocabulary that you mentioned, I think, is a growing concern of mine. I see vocabulary being used more and more individually and uniquely. And there's like, I see so many arguments, especially online, where it seems like people are saying the same thing, but using different words to describe it.
Yep.
And then fighting over those words in a way that's like, you guys are yelling the same thing at one another.
Right. You know? When did this turn into a semantics argument and not an argument about, you know, critical analysis of the work?
So that discourages me a little bit. But I think the shift to a more visual culture hopefully will offset that. You know, I think you see more and more language barriers being crossed with mm-hmm. art. And so hopefully that will kind of pick up some of the slack of, you know, certain language breakdowns. I also think criticism, especially in comics, lags far behind. Man, I hate to say this too, because I feel like this opens me up for a lot of criticism.
No way. We have this conversation almost every week.
I think it lags behind the creative, where the art form is right now.
Yeah. You know,
it seems like there are so many people just running towards the frontiers of comics storytelling, and I don't see comics criticism keeping up. But, you know, hopefully that will catch up. You know, there's more and more college programs that are teaching comics now on a variety of levels, and hopefully we'll see a stronger academic embrace of comics, including the development of language to describe them. Mm-hmm.
Is it also because of the the readership of comics hasn't reached a critical mass in order to cultivate the proper journalistic criticism around it? That's kind of some of what I see. Meaning that
that's possible.
Does that make sense? Sure. You know, like where it's still a small industry. You know, it's not like regular novels where there's a massive readership. So you don't have the incentive for people to talk critically and kind of rise above the noise of the general populace, you know, and to be noticed. Or the other side of that I swing on too is the internet age, has the internet age kind of just like diluted the age of critical thinking or critical discourse, maybe?
It's probably a combination of both of those things plus a few others. Mm. You know, we have access to so many people now that I think it skews our view of the world versus what we think of the world 20 or 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And also when it comes to criticism functioned in the past in a way of, oh, this movie that I'm not able to see because I live in the middle of nowhere or, mm-hmm. you know, before video stores or something, you might read criticism because that was the closest you could get to this particular work. And now it's like you can just find whatever you want instantly online and make up your own mind. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the role of criticism is changing as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's probably to be determined.
Yeah. And in a medium like comics, where it never really, criticism didn't reach the level of publicly prominent as, you know, film criticism or book criticism. So when the need or the role for that critical analysis is shifting in a kind of side discipline in and of itself, it throws things even more out of whack.
Yeah, and I also don't want to imply that there aren't good comics critics.
Oh, yeah, neither do I.
But I think there are some really strong comics critics. It's just that there's so much work being produced now that's exciting and new and different. I don't think there are enough good critics to keep up with it.
Right, there's a lot of noise.
At the moment.
There's
yes.
a lot of noise. Yep.
Yeah, and it's hard for them to gain a general kind of, it's right, it's exactly like the film criticism. There's no like Siskel and Ebert of, you know, comics criticism. And there is, but it's just not, they're not on TV. You know, there's no kind of general population. There's nothing pointing to like, these are the people you listen to when you want to find out about what you should be reading. Or,
do you guys, mm-hmm. do you read like the Comics Journal? For criticism?
Some of it. I read Comics Alliance, and I read some of...
And Comics Bulletin has a lot of good things.
The Comics Journal.
I have this idea about the Comics Journal that, you know, like Gary Groth was sort of part critic and part publisher for a long time, you know, mm-hmm. the publisher of Fantagraphics. And now I feel like he has become almost totally publisher and, you know, very little devotion to criticism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a reflection of where the industry is too, because this is a guy who probably, you know, has a better view of comics than most people. And when faced with a limited amount of time, he has chosen to focus more on the publishing side of it. And I think that might be reflective too of the state of the medium right now, in mm-hmm. that there's a lot of exciting work being done, almost more than anyone can keep up with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's just my guess sort of from a distance. Like, I don't know if that's actually the way he feels about it, but I do think it's interesting to see someone like him who has a history of both. And, you know, in the last decade or so, it seems like it's definitely focused more on the publishing end.
I think that's a nice way of framing what I see happening with just general conversation about new work that's coming out is very positive. I mean, there's a lot of excitement about how many fantastic comics are being produced right now. But there's not a lot of honest, critical discourse about those comics. There's just rah, rah, rah comics. And that's awesome. Like, I can be a cheerleader, too. But sometimes I want to actually have a more academic conversation about the elements of the work. And that's what I feel like has not developed and has not increased with the amount of really great work that's being produced. And I don't know if it's because one is, like you said, caught up with focus on the influx of, like, the kind of critical mass of great comics being produced, or if it's that we don't know how to talk about it, or there are not enough people who know how to talk about it critically. But it's something I think about all the time. Every time another quote-unquote review is posted with, you know, another 11 out of 10 for the next brand new number one issue that's perfect, you know, I'm just like, okay, it's cool, but, like, eventually we're going to have to stop saying that every new comic that's being produced is the best. Eventually we're going to reflect on it, and I would like to think that we'll be able to say this was strong for these following elements, and, you know, this one over here, you know, like we would evaluate any other body of work in another discipline.
Is that how evaluation works, though, in, like, the world of prose publishing?
I don't have experience with prose. My background is in art and theater, and so what I can look at is the similarities in the way that I would evaluate an artist's, like, a visual artist's body of work, or the way that I would look at a playwright or a production, like a live theater production. And the conversations that I would want to have about that, I want to have about comics. And that's where my perspective comes in. I don't think that that is happening in prose. That's my, like, layman's opinion about that.
Yeah, because I wonder if it's just that comics as an industry has started to get to a point that, I don't know how long you all have been reading comics, but when I started, it was possible to read, like, all the Marvel comics that were published, you know, in a month or something, because, I don't know, a busy week might have 10 books coming out or something. Mm-hmm. And now I can't imagine anybody has, you know, like, if you're a completist, this is sort of a terrifying age to be living in. Because how could you keep up with it? You know, right. And on some scale, that's the entire industry. It's just gotten so big now. If you're into fantasy, you can just read fantasy graphic novels or web comics or whatever. If you're into superheroes, you know, you could just read superhero stuff and not worry about anything that's more literary or art oriented. You know, so I think the industry's gotten bigger too. And then it becomes very difficult to compare something like John Porcellino's latest graphic novel to some DC crossover event issue, you know, it's like, it's apples and oranges in a lot of ways.
Which is awesome in and of itself. The variety is, like, spectacular, but I'm just kind of chuckling because we had this conversation at New York Comic Con about, can we just all agree to take a week off, like maybe twice a year, just nothing new comes out, and everybody knows that in advance, maybe the week of Christmas and the week of San Diego Comic-Con. And so you could prepare in advance knowing that you had that week off, and everybody would benefit, readers and creators alike. I think this needs to be a thing.
What a weird world we live in, where, like, the thing we love, we all need to take a week off from.
Just to get caught up on all the stuff that we haven't been able to keep up with. Yep, good stuff.
But so, listening to both of you talk, though, it seems like you'd rather get away from, like, the Twitter cheerleading and more towards, like, YouTube comments. Am I getting this right?
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Sign me up for that.
Okay, sounds good. That'll be the pull quote for this interview. Well, let's talk about collaboration then. How much. You've talked about collaboration and how much you enjoy working with writers and editors and the actual process of creating. Looking at a project like Street Angel, how much of the story development is collaborative? I guess this is kind of a bit of a process question. You know, can you talk about the give and take with telling a story as an artist working with a writer?
Yeah, the way I started working with Brian Maruca, who's the co-creator, co-writer of Street Angel and Aphrodisiac, is we worked together at a day job, and he was a technical writer there, and I was making my own mini comics, which I was writing and drawing. Mm. And once I started seeing his writing, I was like, oh man, this guy knows what he's doing. I'm going to make him give me feedback. Mm. And we were about the same age, and it was kind of a boring company that we worked at. So anytime we were on breaks or at lunch or something, pretty soon we start throwing ideas back and forth. And, you know, we became friends, and it was just a very natural outgrowth of that we started writing together. And that process, it's a lot of give and take. You know, I have a tremendous respect for his work. I think he respects mine. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a lot of trying to make one another laugh, or, you know, you can tell whenever you're impressed by a story. And we would just send ideas back and forth, and they would kind of develop organically that way. Once we get a story into shape that we like it, we essentially are writing short stories. We're writing them as just as prose. And once we're happy with the story and have it worked out, then I tend to take it and turn it into to break it down into like comic book format. And we look at that again, you know. But it's at that point, like once the story's written, it's pretty much me going off and just turning it into a comic. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot different than whenever I did like the Plain Janes with DC or the Guild with Felicia. You know, that was a little more traditional, where they were providing a script. Mm. And then I was adapting their script. You know, I didn't have a lot of story input, and it was working with an editor, so it was a little bit more traditional. With Street Angel, with Aphrodisiac, it's Brian and I just making comics together without any editorial interference or mandate. And so it's a lot of us just trying to write stories that we both like.
I guess that's sort of work for hire versus collaborative independent comics in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, probably.
Is it sometimes kind of freeing to work, just to do work for hire?
It's very freeing. This is going to sound probably bad.
You've been saying that
I've never worked with anyone whose standards are as high as mine. Like I would drive myself crazy, you know, redrawing the folds on a pair of pants on some character in the background. It's not necessarily healthy. I think a lot of cartoonists have OCD tendencies, and mm-hmm. I certainly exhibit those. So working within an editorial system, you know, like the work for hire system in comics, it kind of allows me to ease up a little bit on myself.
That's great.
So that's like, I don't want to imply that I'm turning in bad work, but there is sort of a, you know, a certain amount of a cushion.
Nobody has ever said it quite like that, but I completely understand what you're describing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the editor is the person who's responsible for the work. And quite frankly, you know, I've had work rejected that I was happy with, and work accepted that I wasn't as happy with. And, you know, at some point you have to kind of like shift who is responsible for the work to the person in, you know, a work for hire situation to the editor, which is okay. It's part of collaboration. You know, I mean, if I were not collaborating, I would probably tell a different story. So, you know, it's part of that process. But it is different. It's very different than doing my own work, in which case, if it doesn't work out right, then I am to blame. You know, I tend to be a little more neurotic with that.
This next one that you're not allowed to talk to us about because it's all brand new, is that you on your own?
It's Brian again. And I mean, I can tell you a little bit about it, I suppose. It's new Street Angel work.
Ah, that's awesome.
So,
that's, you know, all you have sure. to say. I'm good. We can be done right now. Like, thanks for chatting with us. That's awesome.
cut to like 2 years from now, whenever none of it's been published. But it's a very different process. Like, it's been a while since I've been working this way, and so I'm not sure what to expect from it. And as of now, it's just, we're just working on some, and we're seeing how it turns out, how long it takes, whether we have things we want to do with the character, whether it's fun to work together, stuff like that. So it's kind of in the earliest stages.
That's something that you're doing while you're working on the conceptual art, and presumably while, you know, Brian's doing, you know, his thing, right?
Right.
Like, this is, okay, cool.
Well, I just want to touch back, and I'm not trying to drive you crazy with this question, but it's something I kind of, it goes back away from the art of comics and the industry of comics, and especially as an independent creator, that your name in the industry, you know, when you talk about kind of being freed from the pressure when you're doing work for hire, your name is still attached to those projects, you know? So I'm always curious of if there is consideration for the work for hire projects you take on and how that reflects career wise. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, and if it's nothing you've ever thought about, I'm not trying to get up in your head.
No, I certainly think about it. You know, I mean, I've turned down a number of projects for one reason or another, and some of that is career consideration. One of the hardest things that I have dealt with in the last 5 years is trying to figure out exactly what I want to do with my life, you know, in terms of a career, in terms of what do I want to wake up in the morning and spend my time doing? And it's very hard to define that. At least it has been for me, because there, you know, it's a vast world. There's a lot of stuff you could do as a visual artist. And so whenever a project comes in, there are a lot of things I weigh about it. Is it something I want to draw? Does it seem fun? You know, I try to look at scripts ahead of time before I commit to a project, because I don't want to get a script that I'm unhappy with. But, you know, it's different criteria depending on the circumstances. If I need some money, or if I have a chunk of free time, I might be more likely to take on a project than if I have a very tight schedule and it's not a project that I'm thrilled about. It's a lot easier to pass on. Mm-hmm. So the criteria changes. You know, if somebody wants me to ink a book at this point, you know, like I turned down a job inking a book not too long ago because that's not really the direction I want to go. Like, mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in doing my own work, whether it's graphic novels or serialized comics or whatever, than I am with getting a steady work for hire job. So, you know, that's why I passed on that particular job. 3 or 4 years ago, that might have been ideal for me.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So there's lots of considerations.
Sure.
Based on, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It's okay. A funny position. You know, if you want to make money, comics are not the best place to do it. It can be done, but it's probably not the easiest place to do it. And so you find yourself doing this because you really like doing it. And it's very different than most people's jobs, I think. You know, I think most people, they wouldn't do the job they're doing if they weren't getting paid. But like, if I weren't getting paid to make comics, then I would just make comics for free. I've done that before. Mm-hmm. You know, I still do that occasionally. Because I love doing it. And so I think it's a different perspective when it comes to career and outlook than the typical person has regarding their job. Mm-hmm. So, one consideration is, I really like doing this. Is it possible to make a living from it? Because then that's all I could do. It'd be great.
Right.
So that's something I think about, you know, and it's something that I've tried to move towards over the last 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Is it time to talk about Pittsburgh now?
Sure.
So I'm always amazed in the way that only a provincial Pittsburgher can be, when I learn that there are people in town, like, still, and they're making awesome comics, and you and Ed Pisker and Frank Santoro and others, and it blows my mind, mostly because I wish that I had known that earlier when I lived there. So I'm curious if you feel being in Pittsburgh, not on the East Coast or the West Coast, not in New York or LA or Portland or San Francisco, do you feel removed from the industry? And is there a benefit to that?
I don't feel removed from the industry. You know, I've been to New York a couple times this year. I've been to San Diego, San Francisco this year. So, like, you know, you can be a visual artist almost anywhere today, mm-hmm. and then just make sure, you know, you get to New York or LA a couple times and you'll be fine. So I don't know that every art form would work in Pittsburgh, but comics are very well suited for it, because so much of making comics requires a relatively small space and you sitting in that space for long periods of time, which means you can make comics literally anywhere.
Right.
The cost of living in Pittsburgh is very low.
Right.
It's probably about as low as you can find for a, you know, medium-sized city. So that part works out really well. You know, and I mean, we talk to people all over the world. Like when we were on the pod, when we were doing our podcast, you talk to people everywhere. Like we're talking from, you know, 2,500 miles away from each other. So right. I think it's easier to feel connected now than it ever has been. Whenever I moved to Pittsburgh, cause I've been here, I moved here in 2000. And at the time I thought, you know, I'm going to become a comic book artist and I can live wherever I want. I'll live wherever my wife gets a job. And over time I've gotten very attached to this region. I think it's a beautiful, you know, geographically, I think it's beautiful. And, I don't know, it seems like a really good place to make comics from my point of view.
That's awesome. I mean, that makes me super happy and also super sad that I'm not there, because that's not really like the impression that I have of my city. And I've only been away from it for 2.5 years. So, obviously my perspective is very specific and very sort of skewed, but I think a lot of it is just that it wasn't really on my radar that things were happening in Pittsburgh, because unlike what you hear about in New York, or Portland is a great example, where there's such a massive number of comic artists there, there are a lot of events and there are a lot of showcases and there are a lot of, you know, shops that are putting things on display. And I guess I wish that that was something that was more embraced in Pittsburgh, but maybe that's changing. Maybe with the Toonzeum and with the Cultural Trust and things like that, where there are more organizations kind of supporting things outside of strict visual arts, or performing arts, that could be something that is also embraced by the region in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, probably 4 or 5 years ago, I was at kind of a crossroads. Whenever I quit my job and started doing this stuff full time, there was a giant vacuum left in my life, because at my day job, I saw 300 people, you know, worked where I worked. And then like one day I stopped going there and suddenly I had no one in my life almost, you know?
Yeah.
And after, I don't know, after a year or so of that, I was feeling very out of touch with everybody. And I started to get more involved in the art community in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And I found them very welcoming. You know, whenever I was, I guess, high school, college age, I kind of distanced myself from the art world because I felt like there was a little bit of comics versus art. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, like that's no decision for me. I was going with comics. So, you know, the hell with the art world. And I was like that for a long time, for, you know, probably 10 years or more. And whenever I came back to, you know, like looking around the art community, at least locally, I was surprised by how welcoming they were to the work that I was making, which was all comics.
Right.
I don't know if that's regional or what. You know, Pittsburgh is such a small city that I feel like everybody kind of has to be welcoming to one another, because the communities are all very small. You know, the visual art community is very small. And I think there's also a history of comics and pop culture in this region that maybe makes it a little bit more welcoming to comics. But I don't know. It is different than Portland. You know, I have lots of friends that live in Portland, and it's definitely not that type of a scene. I don't know if that's a bad thing. Sometimes I think it's good to discourage, you know, like, I don't know that I want this scene to be filled with a bunch of comics makers. It's kind of nice the way it is.
Yeah.
If there were events going on every night, then, you know, maybe you're not getting as many comics actually made if you're out socializing.
Right.
And, you know, I have found a network of people who make comics, like Ed and Tom Scioli's here. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a number of good comic book stores. There's a long history of comic fandom. You know, so it's, I don't know, it's a good balance for me at least.
Awesome.
Well, we usually like to wrap up with suggestions and recommendations, either comics, movies, shows, prose, art, whatever. You just have to make it life-changing, and then you leave us also with a quote, an inspirational quote that will also change people's lives. And then you can shout out people, and then we'll just sign off, and that's it. No pressure.
Well, I'm happy to recommend something.
Okay, that's fine. We'll start there.
One of my favorite graphic novels in the last year is called Jane the Fox and Me. It's by Fanny Britt and Isabel Arsenal.
Okay.
Who I think they typically make picture books out of Montreal, and this is their first graphic novel. It's absolutely beautiful. It's about, it reminds me a little bit of the One Summer, the Jillian Tamaki book that came out, because it's about a young girl, well, a young teenage girl who is kind of adjusting to becoming a teenager and feels ostracized at school. She's, a lot of the friends that she had growing up have kind of pushed her away, and she's reading Jane Austen and finding comfort in that. And it's just this beautiful, amazing book. The artwork's spectacular. The story's good. And I never hear anyone talk about this book. I think it was published by, not by a comics publisher. And so maybe it's not connected with comic audiences as widely as it would have if Fantagraphics or D&Q had published it. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely worth seeking out. It's easy to find. You can get it wherever, you know, you get books.
And I'll link to it on the site so that everybody can find it. Can you give us the title again?
Write a review for it, but I haven't gotten around to that yet. Yes, the title is Jane, the Fox, and Me. It's beautiful.
That's exciting. That's one that I haven't, like, I haven't heard it, heard about it at all. So.
Yeah, me either.
Whoa, if Aaron hasn't heard about it, then
hey, you know what? There's a lot of comics out there. But that's cool.
Yeah, I don't think I have any words of wisdom, I'm afraid.
All right. Save it for next time.
Thank you again to Jim Rugg for joining us on the couch this week. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. See you next week.
The comic that influenced me the most and the character that I love collecting most is The Spirit. So I cannot recommend Will Eisner's The Spirit more highly. If you get a chance to pick up any of the many, many collections of classic Will Eisner Spirit stories, they're like a textbook in both reading and creating comics. They are just storytelling machines with a passion and intelligence and just this very unique take on the comics art form that's really never been equaled before or since. Eisner was an insightful creator, a genius who would just be playing with ideas week to week, because he was creating a comic that appeared in weekly newspapers. The prime time of The Spirit was between 1946 and 1952. Eisner could really experiment, and the best Spirit strips are just wonderful experiments in storytelling. He's kind of the god of comics in America in some ways, and I think he still stands up as well today as he ever did before. Also highly recommended is Darwin Cook's take on The Spirit, which I think is just absolutely gorgeous and wonderful. So if I have to plug, I'll plug my book. The American Comic Book Chronicles, the 1970s, was released in September by Two Morrows Press. It's a beautiful 288-page hardcover, full-color volume that covers the full decade of the 1970s in comics, telling a bunch of insider stories as well as an overview of the decade. And you can read about the rise and fall and slow beginnings of another rise of comics during that time. It's an amazing decade that had a lot of incredible events happen in it. I also co-wrote the 1980s book for the American Comic Book Chronicles, and I am working on a book on the 1990s for the same series. As well, I am part of an ebook that talks about Day Tripper by Moon and Ba, along with Chase Magnet, Keith Silva, Daniel Elkin and Paul Brian McCoy. And I'm in a book called The Ages of the Avengers that will be released around the end of the year, and the follow-up book, The Ages of Iron Man. So I got a few books out there. Go check them out. They're really good. I love them. I think you will love them too. They are awesome and fun and, okay, pride, but they're good. So thanks for listening to me. I hope I haven't been too boring and you've enjoyed hearing what I have to say. I am Jason Sachs at Jason Sachs with a K on the Twitters. Also Comics Bulletin at Comics Bulletin on the Twitters. If you are a lover of comics and want to read or write about them, let me know. Love to have you be part of our group. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Aaron and Andrea. You're the best. Love you guys. Bye.